Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin, you're listening to Up North News.
It is Friday morning, August 5th. I'm Pat Kreitlow, good to have you here. Luke Mathers is our producer. And I didn't tell him ahead of time, but we're going to make Dad Shirt Friday a thing on this program. He doesn't have to. He's young and handsome and can get away with wearing a t-shirt. Some of us of a certain age can't do that anymore. Luke, I wanted to see if maybe it was already a thing. It's not really a thing. If you make the hashtag Dad Shirt Friday and you look on Twitter, the last time anybody used the hashtag Dad Shirt Friday was 2 years ago. And on all of Instagram, if you put in the hashtag Dad Shirt Friday, there have only been 24 posts ever. So I think we're onto something here.
That's a hashtag ripe for the taking then, Pat. You got to claim that one.
It is. I sense merch.
There you go.
I sense merch. This Up North News coffee mug, when we make the next edition, look for Dad shirts on the back of them or something like that. Susan Lampert-Smith joins us for this half hour. She is a freelance writer. I refer to her as our travel writer, even though I know she does a lot more than that. But what we ask of her at Up North News is to, you know, be on the road for us and give us a slice of life, upon all matters of Wisconsin in all sorts of events. And so we want to talk about some of her stories and a bit more of her stories, since we never get to talk about that. So, Susan, good morning.
Hey, Pat. I think we should have like Mom Pants Monday or something.
Mom Pants Monday. Okay.
Those would be those embarrassing yoga pants that, you know, your kids don't want you to wear in public.
There you go. Yoga Pants Monday. We could make something out of that too. It's so good to talk to you, and thank you in person for all of the many stories that you've done for us. It's so appreciated. But I know how much work it is to travel someplace and write about something. But, you know, it's also not the most unenjoyable job either, I would imagine, getting to see all kinds of corners of Wisconsin.
Yeah, I love it. My career back in the day was working for the Wisconsin State Journal, and I started a column called On Wisconsin, which was traveling around the state. It was the best job ever because my bosses never knew where I was.
Yeah. I like that. So you were ahead of your time. Those of us now who work only through Slack and Zoom meetings, you know,
right.
Sometimes we take a meeting and if you keep the camera off, they don't know that you're actually out on the pontoon, you know, taking
exactly.
This meeting. So you were a pioneer in that way.
I used to know where every phone booth was in Wisconsin. That's how long ago it was, before cell phones. So sometimes I'd have to call in my story from the middle of a national forest phone booth.
Oh, yeah. I recall very much my journalism training at UW-Eau Claire, and it was very much an awareness of where the phone booths were. And not only that, this will really take people way back. And I never had to do this, thankfully, but we were taught how to use the little alligator clips to unscrew the mouthpiece and attach the alligator clips to the right leads in the receiver so that you could play your tape recorder for the sound bites that you might have gotten out in the field. And, you know, there were folks that had to do that. Now look at us. I mean, we are editing Instagram reels, you know, videos right on our phones. It's a totally different world of how we convey the story. But the stories are still the same. So you, like you said, you never know where you're going to be in Wisconsin at any given point. But there is something still timeless about the day trip or the weekend trip, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a great state. We could go from the Mississippi River to a great lake, to an island, to a city. You know, they're all doable for a weekend, really.
Yeah, and it would be completely wrong to ask for a favorite, but I am going to ask you about, you know, some of your highlights, things that places that you like to go back to. But I do want to start with our most recent road trip story you did, and that was up to Minocqua, and that was to talk to my friend Kirk Bankstead, who runs what he calls the least popular place in town. Did you get that the sense that the Minocqua Brewing Company was the least popular place in town when you were up there, Susan?
No. In fact, my husband had been by there the few days before, and he's like, oh, is that that gas station where everybody's in there drinking beer? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. You know, I'd been to the old Minocqua Brewery before in the before times, but I hadn't seen their newest iteration, which is an old Texaco station right on the corner. It was a happening place. We were there in the middle of the afternoon on a Wednesday, and it was a steady buzz of people in and out, buying beer, buying t-shirts, asking for travel advice.
Yeah. And it's a place that is not necessarily popular with the locals in a business operated by somebody who is unabashedly progressive and in hostile territory, as it were, politically. But for being a tourist town, if the tourists come through and they like what you're doing and you're on the main drag, you know, that's half the battle right there. As you travel, and we're going to go to break in a couple of seconds here, but as you look toward Labor Day and whatnot, you know, are you filling your summer with travels at all for personal, or are you still mostly working?
Oh, no. In fact, tonight I'm headed up to Hillsboro to the Driftless Music Gardens for a show. That's a new venue that they started during the pandemic. It was on a farm, and it's kind of between La Crosse and Baraboo, way out in the hills. Should be fun.
Oh, yeah, it should be. So, well, that's fantastic. Susan Lampert-Smith is our guest for this half hour. When we come back, more suggestions for ways to go road tripping across Wisconsin right after this break. You're up north.
Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends.
All right, we're going to go cruising across Wisconsin some more with Susan Lampert-Smith for a few minutes here on Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Good to have you here on a Friday. We were talking about that Susan does a lot of destination stories, and for Up North News, she's done things like, you know, what to do when you're in Viroqua or in Janesville or in Sheboygan, and you get this good slice of life from different businesses, different attractions and things. But there's also other themes to her stories. I know one of them that we're getting a lot of traffic on right now is entitled Seven Iconic Wisconsin Church Supper Foods from Lutefisk to Pierogies. I suppose we're not that unusual, Susan, in that we have foods here that you might not find in other states, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're that unusual up here.
Well, no, I mean, I think Wisconsin has some definitely ethnic communities, you know, or neighborhoods in bigger cities. And that's what I really seek out. Like today I'm going to Hillsboro. I'm also going to be doing brewery tours for you coming up soon. And I've heard good things about the Hillsboro Brewery, but Hillsboro is a very Czech community, and they have these festivals where all the Czech ladies make kolaches and all these great bohemian foods that, you know, where else are you going to get that? So those are the suppers I look for, the stuff that, you know, only the grandmas know how to make.
That's true. And it's unfortunate, but yeah, it's those grandmas, they know. In fact, I think I made my mom feel bad recently. I asked for my grandma's recipe for dumplings, and she said she didn't have it, that grandma just made these things in her head. And I thought, well, that's really unfortunate, because there's a lot of good recipes that could be handed down. And you mentioned like corn is going to be a big thing. There's the Loyal Corn Fest. There's all kinds of harvest festivals coming up as well. That any stick out to you that you know you're going to hit or have enjoyed in the past?
Well, you know, another one is, you know, the Native American Wild Rice Festivals. Ricing season starts this month, and that's a really big thing, like on the Mole Lake Reservation. And I think Bad River has a wild rice powwow towards the end of the summer. So, you know, I also try to, you know, if you're driving up north, you see these signs, you know, wild rice at the gas station, and I pull over and get stocked up for the year. But the we could go out wild racing too. You get a permit from the DNR, and I tried it a couple of years ago, and it is so difficult to get more than a cup of rice. Willing to pay anything not to have to do that again.
Well, you think of the things that we see, and we forget the skill level that it takes, not just wild rice, but you know, you go try to tap a tree and get, right, you know, the makings of maple syrup. It's not as easy as picking up, you know, a bottle of Mrs. Butterworth's, you know, on the, right, on the shelf. And, you know, you get to talk to people who do that. One of your recent stories for us back on the subject of beer was over at Old World of Wisconsin. They had wanted to demonstrate beer brewing for the longest time, but they only started recently doing it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I highly recommend it to anyone. And it's kind of an open hearth. I mean, it's very primitive how they're brewing the mash and the wort or whatever that is. But it's how beer making started in the pioneer days in Wisconsin. And what's interesting to me is some of our local, brewers, the craft brewers, have been interested to come there and try things out because there might be flavors added by these old techniques or old ingredients that would create a whole new beer for them. So they also have days where the commercial breweries come in and try things on this old equipment.
Well, it's a great chance to essentially go back to the future that, you know, to get a sense. Your story talked about how, melting pot is probably not the right pun to use in this case, but beer is somewhat universal. But as different ethnicities came to Wisconsin, they brought different ways of brewing beer. So maybe that's part of why Wisconsin is such an iconic beer place, is that there wasn't just one flavor that comes out of this state.
Right. And the guy who's the brewmaster there is super knowledgeable. Like, I didn't know that there's all these Scandinavian beers where they use like pine buds or cedar tips to flavor instead of hops. It kind of gives it that bite, but it's what grew in their climate, and they continue to make that beer here. So was really interesting.
Susan Lampert-Smith is joining us for this half hour, talking about some of her travels around Wisconsin and different theme stories that she does for us. One that sticks out to me recently is the notion of, you know, the company store, and not necessarily the kind like they had, you know, with coal miners who really couldn't get their stuff anyplace else, but stores that, you know, the company has its own, retail center or outlet. And there might be more around here than you think, Susan. You discovered a few of them for us.
Yeah, I mean, when I started it, I realized suddenly there are way too many. And so I think my list is very meat focused. That must have been what I was in the mood for. But, you know, the Johnsonville Brat store up between Sheboygan and Elkhart Lake is amazing. It's a modern architectural building, and they have just interesting brat history there. I'm from Fort Atkinson, so I'm a big loyalist of Jones Dairy Farm, which they have a store where you can buy, they have a different brat every week, seasonal. I know they had like a St. Patrick's Day one that had corned beef in it. And but they're known for their bacon, their ham, and they have really good deals too. Like, you can get the irregularly sliced Canadian bacon and bring home a pile of it. So.
And of course, you know, I've been to the one, the Newski's one in Wittenberg. Yeah. Let's see, a couple that I had not heard of was Grandma Miller's in Hancock.
That's just like this central Wisconsin thing. There's all these, if you drive through the flat central sands part in Wisconsin, in June, it's just a hive of activity with all the pea harvest going on, and they raise all the fresh peas for the canneries. Well, fresh peas, if you've ever had them, are like eating candy. My grandma, who was a farmer, used to raise cannery peas, and I remember sitting in the field as a little kid and eating them until I got sick. So Grandma Miller's is where you go get a 5-10 pound bag of shelled peas, and they're wonderful, and you can only get them that one time a year.
We were, my wife and I were on a drive. We had the top down on the Jeep. We were driving through Tilden, just west of here in Chippewa Falls. And she saw them working a pea field, and it was all she could do not to get out of a moving vehicle and run towards it. She said they didn't grow a lot of peas in Manitowoc County, but when they did, yeah. And when you could get some, she said the same thing you did. It's candy. It just is.
Yeah, that's my grandma was from Manitowoc, and that their farm was just outside the city. And yep, they always had a cannery crop going.
Oh, yeah. In her case, yeah, they were all going to Brilliant for canning. You noted that some things aren't exactly company stores, but they're like food centers. And you singled out Stefano's Slow Food Market in Sheboygan. And again, we get back to that ethnicity of multiple sorts that, again, bring different types of food to Wisconsin.
Yeah, and it's weird because you associate Sheboygan with Germans, but they've, for 30 years had these really great Italian restaurants right downtown, a pizzeria, a more upscale one. And then they had a little shop in the back of one of them that had Italian imports, but it was so popular that they expanded it. And you can get, I can't buy that stuff in Madison, some of the things that are there. So,
yeah. And even in my case, coming from a German and Polish family, but it turned out where I was, my early childhood was in a neighborhood in St. Paul that was Italian. And so I still, whether it's mastacholi or making, to make a ragu from scratch, is very cool because, again, you're exposed to different cultures here in the Midwest, not just the people that came with you. I think you were telling me as well that the same goes for like Asian food stores and restaurants that they're concentrated in areas where, again, you can go to and appreciate that you're not just getting your everyday goulash.
Yeah, one place that I just love also in central Wisconsin is Macon Meats. They're between Stevens Point and Wausau. They're run by the Hmong, and they do butchering of a whole bunch of different animals. Like if you're there on a Friday, people come in with a pig and leave with a cooler full of pork. But sure. They make these fantastic sausages that are ginger, garlic, spicy, Asian flavor sausages that I always stop and get them when I'm up there.
Oh my gosh. Moving from the stuff you'd have for dinner to the stuff afterwards, it turned out as well around Easter time, you shared with us a story about how, the Easter Bunny has plenty of competition. Wisconsin has some candy shops that go back a long way. I mean, I guess I didn't think of Wisconsin as a hub of old candy makers, but they're still around.
Well, yeah, and especially in the Fox River Valley, and I'm not quite sure why that is, but that whole area from Green Bay down through Oshkosh and Fond du Lac has a whole bunch of small family-run chocolate makers that are just, people, they mail home for that, or they go there before the holidays to get stock up on their chocolates from those places.
Yeah, yep, and we list several of them in the article throughout the state that that you can look for. But it's not all just food. Some of your stories have been, about nature as well. You've done one for us already this spring about, field trips put on by the Natural Resources Foundation. You've got another similar story in the works about how people throughout Wisconsin can appreciate the nature that's around them.
Yeah, some of these programs are through the DNR and others are run by the counties or organizations that are trying to promote, for example, bats in Wisconsin. But you can become a volunteer dragonfly monitor and keep track of all the dragonflies on your lake and what species are there and how many you see. And all of that feeds into a network of people that are concerned about different species that are either in danger or they're trying to bring them back. So there were a lot of neat opportunities. And another weird one I came across is you can enter a contest to name Wisconsin's newest lake. There's a lake up by the Wisconsin River near Sauk City that was created, I guess about 30 years ago, they dug a pit for a road project. And because it's in a sandy area, it all filled in with groundwater. And then it gets floods from the river occasionally, so fish have populated it. It's just a beautiful little gem, and it doesn't have a name. It's been called the Barrow Pit. And so the Friends of the Lower Wisconsin River are having a naming contest, and you could win $100 and be the person who named Wisconsin's newest lake.
How great is that? I mean,
I know.
And you know, and when you mentioned the fish, I think of, you know, one of the other theme stories you did for us was for the fishing opener. And everybody, you know, thinks of the Governor's Fishing Opener, which is on a different lake every year. And that's fine. But there are plenty of communities that, you know, have their own little festivals. You don't have to fish to enjoy the fishing opener.
Right. Right. In fact, another one of the bohemian fish communities in Wisconsin is Castle Rock, way out in northern Grant County. And that area is known for trout streams, and they have a big trout breakfast at one of the churches every year.
That's amazing. There's so much more that we're going to talk about and see and do that we can do thanks to the writings of Susan Lampert-Smith. And it is just such a nice pleasure to talk to you. Hope you have a great weekend. Safe travels, and we'll visit again soon.
Too.
Yeah. All right. Take care, Susan. Thanks.
Thanks.
We'll take this break right now, and then more headlines. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
That's pretty much what everybody said after the Brewers blew it again. Lost another walk-off in Pittsburgh, getting swept by the lowly Pirates, and are now tied with the Cardinals atop the National League Central Division. Basically just, you know, doing everything possible to get rid of the four-game lead they had at the start of the week. So we'll see if they can get back on track at home against Cincinnati. Maybe tonight when they celebrate the 1982 World Series team, that will remind them of what winning felt like. And they will go on into that. Luke was kind enough to give me a little Electric Avenue to tee me up for looking at headlines of the past week and things that I can share with you. And one of the notes is about electric cars and the role that they can play, not just for the obvious reason, which of course would be that they're good for the environment, but also, you know, from a straight up money-making reason, you know, tourism. And to do that, Grandpa Pat has to take you back in time to a place where Wisconsin had very few cars, period. And the people that, you know, did have the cars, that, you know, the roads were terrible because they weren't really roads. They were, you know, they were horse paths. I like how Luke has pulled up his chair and is just sitting back for story time here. But for people that were made cars, sold cars, or wanted to just make life easier for people, there was more advocacy for roads, for better roads. And there were people who were heading to this, you know, fairly new national park called Yellowstone. And what eventually happened across our part of central and western Wisconsin was something called the Yellowstone Trail, which was, again, not paved or anything like that, but it was at least something of slightly higher quality for automobile traffic, for these, you know, new car drivers to work their way out west. And so to this day, especially along, say, the Highway 29 corridor here, you'll see either signage or the boulders painted yellow that marked the Yellowstone Trail. So it was a little bit of marketing back in the day to take care of this new technology called the car. And it's what they're going to try doing now with electric cars. So Governor Evers this week, along with three other Midwestern governors, announced that they were going to start a collaborative project to build what they called the next iconic road trip route specifically for electric vehicles. They're going to basically do it around Lake Michigan. So the Lake Michigan EV Circuit Tour, which doesn't have the romance of the Yellowstone Trail, but, you know, why don't we go with Electric Avenue? I think Luke maybe just gave them the marketing idea that they need. But the Lake Michigan EV Circuit Tour will be a network of EV chargers that span more than 1,000 miles of drivable shoreline, you know, around one of our Great Lakes. And of course, you need a multi-state partnership to do that, to build them, to maintain them, but basically turn it into an eco-tourist attraction, but then also enhance, you know, the tourist attractions that are already there. They did refer to it as an electric Route 66, which, you know, again, that maybe that's setting the bar too high, but I think, again, if you you know, evoke that sense of romance and travel. And like we did with Susan Lampert-Smith, people are getting back in their cars now. They're getting back to taking road trips. They've been cooped up for far too long. You know, my wife and I said this year that we were just going to, instead of one big trip, we were going to try to get out of our rut and do new things on the weekends and go see new places. And I think something like this is geared specifically toward that, and especially for those who are embracing a next generation of automobiles. So it will target, you know, some, putting some of these charger installations at key coastal communities, lighthouses, tourist attractions, state parks, breweries, vineyards, restaurants. All of these are going to be tied together with an existing charging infrastructure network that you have in places like, you know, Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Traverse City. So look, I haven't made the move to an electric vehicle yet. I know I fully intend to. I did say yesterday that when I finally give up the, you know, the Jeep Wrangler, I'm going to park my cushy butt in, you know, a cushy vehicle, and it's probably going to be electric powered. The only thing I think they need to change, Luke, is that, you know, they don't make noise. Those electric vehicles don't make noise. And more than a couple of people have gotten hit because they didn't even see it coming.
I think that the sports car electric, because Ford did a Mustang now. Ford has an electric Mustang, and I think they have in it, it makes a sound similar to the classic muscle car Mustang. And so They are starting to I think, I don't know if it's an added feature or what you would necessarily classify that as, but that has been some people's concern and delay for changing away from the American muscle cars to electric vehicles, because they do miss that noise. And I think it's something that the auto manufacturers are working on.
Well, and with those improvements comes a new incentive. We talked earlier about how the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the newest domestic policy package put together by Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Chuck Schumer, and now Senator Kyrsten Sinema says she's going to support it. That Inflation Reduction Act is made up of several components, and one of them involves a new tax credit. If you buy an electric vehicle, you can get a $7,500 tax credit applied at the point of sale. And that will be available to the couples earning under $300,000 a year, for individuals, $150,000. So because I know more than a couple of people have said, oh, electric vehicles are, you know, rich people toys. Well, you know, again, like everything, things start very expensive, then they get scalable and more affordable. So as that's happening, you bring that tax credit down to people who, you know, don't need it nearly as much. And what that means is tens of millions of people will now qualify for the credits. There will also be consumer rebates if you install more efficient heat pumps or solar panels in your home and more. There is a climate analysis group called Rewiring America, quoted in the Washington Post as saying that if consumers were to claim all of the subsidies in the bill, they could save nearly $2,000 a year in energy savings. And that is, so it's not just the, you know, electric vehicle tax incentive that's part of this Inflation Reduction Act, but it's part of the climate initiatives that you'll find in there as well. As I look through this review of it, there is $1.5 billion in rewards for cutting methane emissions. That's provided to, you know, oil and gas companies to cut their emissions, because we couldn't count on them to just do it out of the goodness of their heart. But we, you know, if that's what you have to provide to, you know, clean up the environment, then let's do it. There's another $260 billion in other clean energy tax credits as we continue to expand solar and wind and hydro. And that's just the future. That's just where we are now. And, you know, contrast that with the, you know, the ongoing apologists, essentially, for the oil and gas industry, who continue to cling to the same talking points. You know, one of my favorites, Luke, is the ones that say, you know, well, you know, what good is it to have windmills? You know, the wind doesn't blow all the time. Yeah, we know, but it often does. Nobody's saying that your TV won't work if the wind ain't blowing, and yet they love to do that. It's crazy.
Yeah, and same goes for argument against solar panels. But you see plenty of areas where you don't need a sunny sky like Arizona to be able to power solar panels. There's technology that even on a cloudy day, when you get sunburn, solar panels are still taking in the sun's natural light to be able to power those batteries.
So I'm thinking, where did I hear that before? And I found it here, one of our daily newsletters, and it was from July 5th. So 1 month ago was a story about how Congressman Tom Tiffany, who represents us up north, sought to minimize the science behind a changing climate, going so far as to thank the Lord there was climate change 10,000 years ago when ice covered much of Wisconsin. Tiffany at the time had been on Capital City Sunday, which comes out at WKOW-TV, and he continues to express doubt about whether humans are responsible for a changing climate. He referred to it as, you know, a slight change in temperature. Slight by a number, not slight at all by what it's done to the Earth. Tiffany repeated a lie that is frequently used by fossil fuel advocates about the Texas electrical grid. Tiffany claimed that the problems with the Texas grid are because they relied too much on wind and solar. I'm going to say that again. Tom Tiffany thought there were problems with the electric grid because there was too much renewable energy on there, when the actual story is that the Texas officials did a poor job of preparing their grid for cold weather, which does still happen in Texas, much as we talked to Cam Stevenson earlier in the show, that cold weather comes to Arizona. You have to plan for what you've got. And in Texas, they do get cold snaps, more so, again, with a changing climate. You're going to get wilder swings in temperatures. And as a result, yeah, the wind turbines there froze up, because they didn't plan for them when they built them. They have since started making those repairs to be ready. But for Tiffany to claim that it's all wind power overall is the problem is either ignorant or uninformed, or I would contend intentional, as a way to continue to carry water, you know, for the oil and gas companies. But what really took the cake for me was when he tried to equate it to what happened 10,000 years ago, when he said, well, Thank the Lord for climate change back then, because otherwise we'd still be covered in glaciers. I don't think I've heard anything more apples and oranges come out of a public official's mouth in my life, because it doesn't take much to look back at the data and see that what happened then bears very little resemblance to the rapid buildup of carbon dioxide to levels that have not been seen here in 2.5 million years, okay? Not 10,000 years ago. You have to go back 2.5 million years to have as much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we have right now. So no, Congressman Tiffany, this is not a matter of thanking the Lord for a changing climate. This is something that is man-made. It is something that we can still do something about in two different areas. We can, you know, mitigate the effects of climate change. And what does that mean? It means we're going to get more floods. We're going to get stronger storms. So let's work on that by, you know, when a bridge gets washed out, when you rebuild that bridge, you know, build it to higher standards. If you have people who live in flood prone communities, then, you know, buy them out and get them out of there, because that's cheaper than having to rescue them and rebuild all the time. So that's the one thing you can do, is you can mitigate the impact of a changing climate. And then the other is to stop being part of the problem. You know, again, you're not going to change things overnight. And that's what a lot of, you know, opponents of doing anything on the climate contend is like, well, you can't fix it anyway. Here's the thing. I'm living on Lake Wissota, and even if all the other neighbors were peeing into it, you could still not contribute to the problem by maybe using indoor plumbing yourself. And that's really what this is about with, you know, this Inflation Reduction Act and the things that are in there that can mitigate, you know, and help stop contributing to the problem. And that's what we're really going to see now. in this Inflation Reduction Act, and in, I think, just that change of heart of actually, you know, not being like President Trump and pulling out of, you know, the Paris Accords, but not being afraid to embrace this, to see it as not just necessary, but see it as an opportunity. There are jobs to be found in building and maintaining wind turbines. There are jobs to be made and filled in electric vehicles and in making homes more energy efficient. And there are jobs and there's money to be made in building a Route 66 of electric vehicles to go around one of our Great Lakes and see all kinds of great things on a Wisconsin-Michigan road trip. So go have fun with this. We'll take a break. We'll wrap up the show in just a moment. I'm Pat Crightwell, and you're up north.
Down to Electric Avenue.
Oh, yeah. Rocking in the daytime.
Electric Avenue.
Rocking in the night.
Take it higher.
Electric Avenue.
Rocking in Miami.
We'll wait for Huey to, there we go. There's Huey Lewis getting us into the weekend. It was one of those, when the song came out, I was working at the time, my summer job was at the Valley Fair Amusement Park in the Twin Cities. And so you'd hear that thing screaming out of the 73 Plymouth Fury that I drove to work every day. Tuesday is election day, it's primary election day. You need to vote. Whether you're voting, and you can only vote in one party's primary. So whether you're voting in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary, you should vote. Some of these races are extremely important, and you should have a say in who your party's nominee is for this office or that office. But I can also tell you from personal experience that if you skip an election, it may come back to haunt you, because, you know, you're supposed to be a good citizen. Didn't we just talk about Tim Michaels, who did not vote in the 2016 primary for Donald Trump? and has
Tim Michaels is so funny. Like, I just don't understand it. I don't.
He's saying he didn't. Rebecca Clefish didn't support Trump. You didn't vote. You should really sit down on this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was running for Congress in 2012, I want to say it was 2012 or was it legislature in 2010? No, it was Congress in 2012. I had a staff member who, you know, was much better connected to, you know, the ins and outs of running a campaign. And she said, well, one of the things you have to do as a candidate is you basically have to hire a private investigator to investigate you. You know, what is really out there? If somebody were to dig around, what would they find? And you may think there's nothing out there, but, you know, you may have forgotten, you know, what you did or something, or thought something was innocuous, like, you know, not voting in the 2016 primary, Tim Michaels. Anyway, so I'm with her in the car, and this was sometime afterwards. I'd long since forgotten about it. And her cell phone rings. I was taking a turn driving at that point. And I just hear her go, oh, yeah, hi, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. Are you sure? Okay, uh-huh. Thank you. She hangs up the phone, says that was the agency, the, you know, the investigative agency that had done their research on me. That didn't sound like great news to me. I was waiting for the hammer to drop to find out what it is that could be, you know, so terrible out there. And she said, did you not vote in the 2004 presidential election? And I immediately lit up because I, you know, in a happy way, I'm like, that's the thing. That's what they're going to hit me on, is that I skipped a presidential election. Because in this case, I did. I'm guilty. You look like you were going to say something there, Luke. You were going to shame me for not voting.
No, I also didn't vote in that election. But
you were 8 years old.
I was 10 years old.
You were 10 years old. Shut up. Turn your mic back off. So there I was having to defend not voting in, you know, John Kerry, George W. Bush facing off. And I had to tell her the story of, you know, I was anchoring the news at Channel 13 at the time. And You know, the TV business is funny. In the off years, the odd numbered years, TV stations and radio stations too can be so cash strapped that I remember one time when they ran out of toilet paper. And it was kind of the, you know, well, you know, we're waiting, you know, cash flow, you might have to bring in a roll. You know, they didn't really get to that point, but there were certainly jokes about it that, you know, office supplies had run low and such. That's the odd numbered years in the TV business. In the even numbered years, when all the political ads are running, I mean, the dump truck is backing up and just pouring cash into the station. And so every even numbered year, we would have the cash to get we got a new computer system one year. We got a new set. And in this one particular year, this was the year we were getting a new newsroom. They were completely gutting, you know, what had been there for the, you know, 40 years or so previous, and basically rebuilding the newsroom. We thought that was great news. When did they decide to do this? The October of an election year. So there we are in a makeshift studio while they're working on the new studio and working in the newsroom. And it was great to have all this new stuff, but you know, you had wires hanging from the ceiling everywhere and hoping the fire marshal didn't shut you down between the weather and sports. Much like what Luke has, for those of you watching on video, it looks like a death trap behind him. That was the situation that we faced in the fall of 2004. And I was one of the few who understood how the election software worked that put the, you know, the vote totals up on the screen. It's a totally different software program. And I was one of the few people that knew how to operate it. So although I was doing everything possible to prepare for election night 2004 and thought I was going to take a break at some point during the day to go up to the Eagle Point Town Hall, which is one of the most beautiful town halls in the middle of Chippewa County, and vote, I just couldn't get away. I couldn't get away because I was preparing to do election night coverage in 2004. So my thought was, you know, if that's, you know, what they want to hit me on, that I didn't vote, I've got a ready-made excuse. I've got a newsroom that was stripped to the bones and a computer system that had to be programmed, because otherwise we were thinking we're going to have to bring in chalkboards, you know, and write the numbers on there to tell people what's going on.
Just like a prehistoric Steve Kornacki, just like chalkboard.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I'd love to see Steve Kornacki do all this with a blackboard. Sorry, that's not going to work that way. So in the last couple of seconds that we have left here, I just wanted to hit on, you know, things that we talked about this week, because we've had a great first week here. And I want to again express my appreciation to Wausau Mayor Katie Rosenberg for being our very first guest, where we didn't just talk about the goats, and the goats are gone now, but the goats did their thing, taking on invasive species, you know, in one of the parks. But we talked about the continued threat of PFAS contamination and the things that they're trying to do to help make sure that residents in Wausau continue to have clean water. And we then talked to Nancy Stencil, who told us about a proposed mining project in Marathon County, where just the test drilling alone could introduce PFAS into the water because of some of the materials that are used in the boring process. Our big thing this week was to talk to all four of the Democratic candidates who are running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. And they all talked about what would make them the better representative. Brad Paff stood out by saying he would not necessarily support an assault weapons ban, but all of them talked about what an improvement they would be over the Republican nominee, Derek Van Orden. So we really appreciated the time with them. I want to thank Robert Craig from Citizen Action, who spoke with us on Wednesday on being one of democracy's little helpers and getting people informed on how to vote. And of course, Senator Tammy Baldwin joined us yesterday to talk a bit more about the Inflation Reduction Act and the many benefits it'll have when it passes this weekend. So thank you for joining us for the first week of Up North News, the radio show. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.